I don't still don't fucking understand Facebook. I don't get it. I don't get how to use it. I get how to use it like physically, but I don't like understand it. It like I don't know.
You don't
Maybe
understand Facebook etiquette.
I don't know if it's just etiquette or if it's just I don't like I really don't give a fuck.
Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from California, Southern California, you are Cassidy Robinson.
I am. On my better days, I am.
Just on your good days.
Still got 2 more weeks of school left and I'm kind of freaking out. I shouldn't even be doing this right now. I'm using this as a reason to procrastinate. But today's Mother's Day.
That is a thing, yes. Did you talk to your mother? Did you thank her?
I did. I called.
For not suffocating you with a pillow when you were one.
It's the least you could do.
Yeah.
Not suffocate me.
Well, that's, you know, the first thing that should happen.
Yes. Did you contact your mother?
Of course I did. We contacted the moms and the mother-in-laws and so on and so forth. So.
Did you FaceTime?
Did we FaceTime? We did Skype with my mother-in-law.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Does that make you better than me?
Yes.
I was afraid of that.
Happens often, so, you know, should be afraid a lot then.
My mom tried to FaceTime me the first time I told her I had a new phone.
How did that go?
And I have an Apple or an iPhone. Uh-huh. So if you know, it's a free thing you can do is basically it's like mini Skype.
No, yeah, I know what it is.
Yeah.
Are you describing to our listeners? Because yes. They're probably smarter than we are about.
Why is he talking? Of course we know. So there's this thing called Google. And
yeah.
It's like a website, but you use it to find other websites.
Yeah, that's how dumb we are about this stuff, folks.
But anyway, so yeah, I texted her and I was like, I have a phone now. So, and then she immediately tried to FaceTime me. And I was like, no, when I like hung up, like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's actually like I think we've had phones for so long that it's almost invasive to have somebody like looking at you.
Yeah, it's like I'd rather not. I'm not even like totally dressed, my hair's a mess.
Right. The dream of all science fiction, and then it gets here and it's like, No. I don't want to see you either. Yeah, right.
So, yeah, of course, obviously, our listeners will not be listening to this on Mother's Day, but we are recording on...
We're talking to each other on the day we should be talking to our mothers.
Instead, yes. You're like, doing this whole, like, horror convention weekend, right?
Yeah, it was the World Horror Convention.
I was able to rip you away from it for a little while.
Yeah. No, I've... Yeah, it's been pretty great, so...
Pretty cray?
Been pretty cray, pretty cray. No, it's really been good. People are really friendly. It's catered towards specifically towards writing. Got to meet a lot of cool people.
Like in the comic industry or the movie industry or what?
A little bit of, I guess, a little bit of everything, really.
Hmm.
This
what is the convention called?
It's called the World Horror Convention.
So this is the horror convention.
Yeah, they do the Bram Stoker Awards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I went to those. Somebody gave me a free ticket. And
nice.
I ate and watched them. I was like the only one in a t-shirt. It was pretty sweet.
It's like a black tie event.
Yeah, and I show up in like with my backpack and like an asshole and just wander around. But I had fun, so I don't really care.
Yeah.
No, it was a lot of fun, you know. There were different people there. Somebody who was like very delightful was Victoria Price, who is Vincent Price's daughter.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
She talked a bit about him, and she also just kind of talked about art in general. Let's see, Greg Staples, who did a lot of the Judge Dredd stuff, he was there. The Grandmaster, who was very kind and very nice to me, and I got to talk to him a bit, was Brian Keene. He's done comic books and novels, and they accredit him to the revival of zombies, and specifically his book kind of predated even like 28 Days Later and stuff like that, and kind of prompted that, a lot of people say. Really, really cool guy.
Cool.
Let's see, let's watch some like short films, some short horror films that were actually pretty decent. I thought they were pretty cool.
Were they like done locally, or people like premiering them there from other places?
A little bit of both. Let's see, what else? Oh, I met one of the authors I was into that I saw, Jack Ketchum. For people who know, he writes some really hardcore horror. Really good, like his stuff is really, like his prose is like very pretty in his work.
Okay.
But some of the stuff that happens is some of the most, you know me and you know my tolerance.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff, like I put down The Girl Next Door. Because it bothered me that much.
So, not like the Emil Hirsch comedy, but...
Yeah, no. Very, very different. Based on a real situation, and it's rough, but very excellent writer. Trying to think.
Did you plug our podcast anywhere?
I did a little bit. I did talk. I talked to some people about it. I actually talked to a fellow from a horror podcast in Canada, and he said he'd heard of our podcast. And I was like, what?
No, he hasn't.
Yeah, I don't
that
think
so. That is bullshit.
I feel like
I that's call kind bullshit of... on that Canadian. I mean, if he has, like, cool, but no.
I feel that way.
I think he might have been trying to be nice, but you should work that anyway.
Yeah, I should, right? I'd be like, yeah, I'm famous. No.
Like, oh, yeah, what's your favorite episode? What was our last pet topic?
Fair enough.
Right, let's go ahead and get on to the movie news. I'll let you go first. What do you have?
So I ran across this, and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is an eclectic cast. Holy cow. So Judd Apatow is going to be doing a movie so it just announced that they were putting LeBron James in it, the Heat basketball player. But this is the cast. Okay. So besides LeBron. Yeah. So it's going to be the rising comedian as a star, Amy Schumer. But joining her is Bill Hader, Brie Larson, Colin Quinn, Vanessa Bayer, Tilda Swinton, John Cena, and Michael Burr-blah-blah.
I can usually say it, you motherfucker. Birbiglia.
Birbiglia, okay.
I actually saw him do stand-up live.
Cool.
At the Sasquatch Music Festival. Yeah, that is a pretty crazy cast.
Very strange. I also like when you add in the ranks of like John Cena, the WWE wrestler.
He's kind of like on the rise. Like I think he really wants to be the next Dwayne Johnson, because he started out like doing like movies like 12 Rounds, which is like a WWE Presents direct-to-DVD action movie. But now I'm seeing him like in smaller parts of bigger action movies. Like, I think he might have been in an Expendable, or is going to be.
He's been in random like those straight to DVD like films and stuff like that.
He has his eye on acting.
They have a crowd.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does kind of make sense. I understand why people are always trepidatious about wrestling actors, though, but...
Yeah, Jeep Swenson in Batman and Robin. So Judd Apatow, I mean, he's kind of becoming more and more famous for doing that, is, like, getting random actors, like, within his production company, not just his movies, but, like, getting, like, P. Diddy to do a comedic role, and it's like, oh, we wouldn't have expected P. Diddy to do a comedic role. Like, he's becoming more and more famous for, like, using his Hollywood connections and, like, bringing in random people to, like, riff with other well-known comedians.
With the clout kind of thing.
Yeah. That's kind of becoming all part of the Apatow brand.
Well, that's what I wondered when I heard this all. I was like, okay, are they going to be bit players, or are they like a little bit more integral? What's going on with them? But I don't know. It still just made me chuckle that you had Tilda Swinton next to John Cena. So
I'm there. All right. My first story, and I know you're just gushing with excitement, so you'll have to contain yourself till I'm done reading this, but Lionsgate sets Power Rangers movie as franchise starter. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it. I'm reading the article now. There doesn't really seem much more interesting than that. So we've had a Power Rangers movie before, a couple.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of an event for me as a kid. I remember seeing that in the Spud Drive-In in Driggs, Idaho.
Oh, wow.
With my cousins in the back of their pickup. And it's actually funny.
Very geographical.
Yes. Everything I said there. I'm from the Midwest, y'all.
Is that the Midwest?
No, Intermountain West, if you will. But anyway, so I remember watching that, and like, you know, I'm with all of my cousins. A couple of them are in their teens already. I was like 12, so I was like the appropriate age, maybe younger. I was probably like 9 when that first Power Rangers movie came out. And I remember there's that scene in the middle of the movie where they meet like the woman on the other planet who's like in nothing but like a beige bikini.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives them their ninja powers. I don't know if you ever saw the movie.
Nope.
But I remember like I was with my aunt and uncle and all of my cousins, and when that scene came on, she looked at my older cousins like, now I know why you wanted to come to this.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Not because it's the Power Rangers.
Well, they were like 15, so they should have been too old for it at that point. But so you're not pumped for this.
Well, okay. So but I have to explain. When I was a kid, when I was in first grade, is kind of when the Power Rangers first had their big thing, you know? And I watched a couple episodes, like, you know, any kid of that age, you know, Saturday mornings, and I was like, I don't like it. And I feel like they're trying to replace the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I don't like that. Yeah. So I was at school one day, and this kid had all these Power Ranger cards, and I was like, I don't really like the Power Rangers. And he's like, well, you're dumb. And he pushed me. And so that's my feeling about Power Rangers, is that they're dumb.
It's linked with childhood trauma for you.
Yeah. No, yes, that's
you
exactly
felt ostracized why. Because you weren't into Power Rangers and everyone else was. What's funny
I
is...
I still feel that way.
Even at a young age, even when I was a little kid,
uh-huh.
I had to be a closet Power Ranger fan. Like, you couldn't just, like, be like, oh, yeah. Like, even at, like, a young, young age, when I was, like, third, fourth grade, kids were like, oh, Power Rangers is stupid, eh. And then you would, like, hang out with them after school and, like, see all their toys.
That wasn't the case in my grade school. Case in my grade school is everybody had it. And
just
I
everyone
was
open, like, just, yay, Power Rangers.
Yeah, everybody was like, yeah, Power Rangers are awesome, blah, blah, blah. You want to play the SNES game? And I was... like, I guess.
I was kind of good at that. No, I had the Sega Genesis movie tie-in game.
I don't know which one this was. You know, the one thing that I will say about them is I did like their monsters when I was a kid. And
well, it's basically, you know, we'll be talking about Godzilla next week. But it was basically, because it's a really bizarre show if you think about it. Like, it was this old show done in the 80s, or like late 70s, I think even some of them, done in Japan. And it was just like, it was like a weird combination of kind of giant mech shows and like anime-ish type ideas put in like really lo-fi, like Godzilla kaiju kind of stuff. And it was just a big, like, you know, crazy Mondo thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they like exported Saban, who like made it popular in America, exported all of this random footage from this old show, and then filmed all of these, exteriors and all of this like story stuff with these American teenage actors in the 90s, and then like edit them together to create this, you know, superhero show basically. And it was it was as disjointed as it sounds like it should be.
Yeah, and as a kid, I was always, well, one of my problems with it was that it was really repetitive.
Yeah, every episode was exactly the same.
Yeah, they sent a monster, and then they beat it up a little bit, but then it beat them up a little bit. And, mm-hmm. But then they beat it up a little bit, and then it got big, and then they got in their Zords, and then they beat it up, and then they won. Yeah. And then Rita was mad.
Yeah, every once in a while, that might get stretched to a two-parter.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it was the exact same formula.
Yeah, Yeah, and then I was still like, yes, Ninja Turtles. And then, I remember I got pushed dumb because I like the Ninja Turtles.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. It's okay. We can move on.
We can move on. I have a really strange story here. Earlier in the podcast, we reviewed Richard Linklater's film Bernie, which is based on a true crime story from, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, about a funeral director who killed a widow on sort of on purpose, on accident. And kept her body in a freezer for 9 months or something like that and ended up going to prison. It's a dark comedy, stars Jack Black. Quite funny, I think. Well, the real-life Bernie Tita just got released from prison due to some new evidence that came in about this past trauma in his life and sexual abuse that he endured. That may or may have not have been triggered by this relationship he had with this kind of bitter widow. But he's been released. He's on house arrest right now, and he's living with Richard Linklater, who has to make sure that he is, you know, under surveillance at all times and is calling his PO and
doing that's part of his conditions of release.
Yeah.
Is that he has to live with Richard Linklater.
That's the part of him. That, like, he can't live with, like, family or something.
Apparently, but I find that very, very funny. I find that even more funny.
Yeah.
The best part of the movie was that a lot of those reactions were like real people's reactions. It's kind of filmed around it, talking about like disjointed kind of strangeness, but
it kind of has like a mockumentary vibe, almost like a Christopher Guest meets the Coen brothers.
Sure.
And there's a lot of like these talking head interviews intermingling, and some of them are actors and some of them are actually people who lived in the town and were around for that trial.
And so, I don't know, this is like almost a setup for Bernie too.
It is. Based upon the little we know from the movie, uh-huh. and maybe there's a little bit of footage at the very end of the actual Bernie.
But if he doesn't like how Jack Black did it, he sees the movie for the first time, then he murders Richard Linklater.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Given what we know, would you be worried if you were Richard Linklater?
Probably not, I guess. But
so you buy into the whole thing that he's just this really sweet guy, and it was just a bad situation, and he went too far and shot a woman
in the heat of the moment or something. Yeah,
yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, he obviously murdered the person.
Yeah,
so it's a very strange. Situation.
You know,
and this is Texas.
This is a state that's well known for just, like, giving people the death penalty for fun. And here they let out a cold-blooded murderer. Like,
he wasn't cold-blooded. It was the heat of the moment.
Yeah, I understand, but still, like, they put away people for less.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding.
Like, confessed to it and everything.
It kind of almost makes the movie more amusing.
Oh, I rewatched it after I saw this story, and I love that movie anyway. I just think it's hilarious. But it's just crazy. And then on top of this, I didn't post this on our Facebook because it's not movie related exactly. But Michael Ealing, the famous party monster, you may remember the movie with Macaulay Culkin.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
Where he was like this guy from the club kid in New York in the 80s and 90s, and
I remember the cover. I've never seen it.
Yeah, he killed his drug dealer. In the middle of a fight, like maybe self defense, but nobody really knows because they weren't there. But he also to make sure that this drug dealer was dead, poured Drano in his mouth, taped his mouth shut. Chopped his body up, put it in a box, had the box in his house for over a week before he threw it off the Brooklyn Bridge. That guy just got released out of prison, too.
I feel strange. Okay, this is, we're living in a weird world. We're just casually murdering somebody is okay after 10 years or so.
Apparently, I don't know. There's a statute of limitations if you're charismatic enough.
I guess. It was good behavior. I ate my pudding and everything.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go ahead and get on to the pet topic.
Well, who was the director of... We didn't talk about Robert Orci.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you went completely out of order, sir. Anyways, Robert Orci, I know how excited you are that Robert Orci will be directing Star Trek III.
Yeah, there's that. I think I wanted to forget.
Did you? Yeah, it's definitely like a Freudian thing.
Robert Orci, for people who don't know, he's a famous screenwriter in Hollywood. He wrote he was a co-writer on the first two Star Trek movies. He's a co-writer on the, him and Kurtzman wrote the Transformer trilogy, the Spider-Man new reboots, the one we reviewed last week. And he's never directed a movie before.
Nope.
I think the other one, Kurtzman, directed a little indie that they wrote together that starred Chris Pine.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
I don't remember the movie, but...
Yeah, I forgot what it was called. It kind of came and went. But it was sort of like their, like, hey, we can do real movies too thing.
Okay.
But he's never been a director before, but now they're handing him the reins to do Star Trek III now that J.J. Abrams is doing Star Wars.
Sounds like a bad idea. I don't know. The other two, I mean, whether you dislike the second one or not, they were still pretty strong films in my regard. And
no, I really like the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I do as well.
Way more than anything else that Orci's been connected to.
Sure.
And I mean, I still see his writing failures in those movies.
Mm-hmm.
His tendency for really mechanical screenplays where scenes are just there to set up other scenes, and over-threading and over-plotting. I see those even happen in those movies, but I think that J.J. Abrams was able, he's such a good director and he's so capable that I think, you know, he probably either tamed it down in the editing room or knew sort of how to direct around his hackish writing.
Yeah, I, you know, he is attached to a lot of tripe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. To me, this is kind of a bad step, but it also says probably. So that doesn't necessarily...
He's in talks.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, and I know that he's kind of pushed himself towards that, because this isn't the first time I've heard the rumor either.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. To me, it's like... I'm hoping that they don't still.
Yeah.
Once it gets confirmed, then well, but this is pretty, but if it did happen, yes, it would be a bad situation. And I wouldn't have, this would be like, this was like Shatner's fifth movie. They're probably going to fight like Buddha or something in this one. I don't know. Like some extraterrestrial Buddha. I don't know.
Right. It's called, that movie I was talking about, the indie that they did, or the little pseudo indie, it's called People Like Us, and it has Elizabeth Banks and Chris Pine.
I think my wife watched that a little bit ago.
Yeah, I never saw it. I remember when it came out though, and that was directed by Alex Kurtzman, but okay. Orci co-wrote it with him.
So he doesn't even have any props.
No, I mean up until this point, Orci is only known for writing, and not very good writing for that. But yeah, so we'll see what happens there.
What if it's fantastic and people just don't get his writing? How would you feel about
that? They just don't know how to translate it to the screen. You know what? I don't go into movies wanting to hate them. So hopefully that's the case. Hopefully that's the case. I just seriously doubt it.
Well, hopefully the case is just wrong.
Yeah. Hopefully it just won't happen like that, but let's go ahead and get into the pet topic. What did you have for us this week?
Okay, so what I have like a what-if situation, you know? So it's kind of what if the foreign market dropped out of the movie market, and that was the foreign market in the movie.
Oh, okay.
For movies, what if that dropped out and there was no, and it didn't exist? Where would they go for their money, and how would movies?
What
do you think movies would happen to them?
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting question, because obviously the foreign market, especially for American Hollywood mainstream films, is almost more the point than domestic anymore. Right. Especially when you're talking about movies like an Orky Kurtzman event, like Transformers or Spider-Man, they are really dependent on the foreign markets, because they spend over $200 million on those movies in, you know, technology alone, and on marketing before they even come out, and they have to make triple that back. So you're talking, you know, if a movie's $150 or $200 million, it has to make $600 million back to make a profit.
Well, and sometimes they do, like
yeah, usually they do.
Isn't it like the Ice Age movies are kind of like that?
Yeah,
like,
the Ice Age movies specifically have more appeal overseas than they do here. We have to see them still, but they know, it's been known for years that those movies have just kind of ebbed. They don't do better or worse domestically, but they do exponentially better every time there's a new sequel overseas.
Right.
So those movies are not for us. Specifically, what's interesting about this is that a lot of people think that the reason the foreign market expanded the way it did, and that we're selling a lot more to China, and we've built, you know, a whole cinematic infrastructure there, as well as places like Russia, the UK, obviously, which has been kind of a thing for a while, but more specifically China and Russia, is because of the death of the DVD market. DVD used to kind of fill that hole. Mm-hmm. And then DVD sort of died after the stock market went down, and after streaming and all of these other things went up, and pirating. So to fill that gap, they expand the foreign market, and now movies open wider than they ever have before. So if that died, and there's no, you know, for whatever reason, all the people in China is like, we're sick of blockbusters. We're done. They start making movies for themselves, and they don't really need Americans to do it for them anymore.
Well, that's what I was going to say was more likely to happen.
Yeah, and they're not going to make them in the same way we do and have them play here. You know, if that happened, and which very well might happen, I don't know about anytime soon, but in the next 30, 40, 50 years, that probably could and will happen. There would need to be a plan C, plan D on that, and I think what you would end up seeing is probably more movies that are direct to demand.
Mm-hmm.
So they might play on limited, you know, they'd be made much cheaper. You would not have your $200 million movies anymore if you couldn't depend on the foreign market to make that back. So you would start seeing more mid-level movies again, like 30 to 40, or maybe even lower. And it would open on more than just, you'd probably have a limited release domestically, like you would, say, a movie like Only Lovers Left Alive, which we're going to be reviewing this week. It probably open same day on Netflix, on iTunes, and all of these things as well. They were just trying to scramble to get money wherever they could.
Well, I mean, what's kind of interesting is I already feel like there's kind of almost a movement towards, sorry, I've got this on the brain a little bit, I guess. There's already been kind of a movement towards horror within those kind of lower price ranges.
Yeah.
In
a lot of your genre film stuff is like that. Yeah.
Well, they're a constant way to get your money back. You can make them for really cheap. You can put schlocky people in them, and
yeah, you don't need stars to sell a movie.
And a lot of times, you know, they may if it's $1 million movie and they only make 30-40, they're still probably making a good margin.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting about that is I you know, to me, if that foreign market crashed, I think they would boom again, even more so, which is kind of good for me. But at the same time, I don't know, I don't want necessarily the tentpole movie. I want the bad tentpole movies to go away, of course. Like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 can just, like, shove it. But, yeah, I'm still condemning that. Just don't go see that.
You're still mad.
Yeah, I'm still pissed.
All right.
You know, I don't know.
I don't think it would go away forever.
But do you think this would be a good thing to happen to film? I don't know if it would be. I still think that they would make shitty movies.
They would still make shitty movies. But I think the model would change. The model would shift. Mm. And in some regards, maybe shift for the better. Now, it depends on how, if you're really into the idea of the cinematic experience, if you're really into the idea of going into a dark room and seeing a movie with a bunch of strangers, that I think would become less and less. I think less movies would come out in general. And I think less movies would be seen by people in a theater. I think half of the market, even in the mainstream Hollywood, you'd have day and date. So you might be able to see it in a theater if you live in LA, New York, Portland, bigger cities. But if you live, you know, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, these kind of places, you'd probably only be able to watch it on demand, which we're seeing a lot with, like, lower budget horror, indie comedy, these kinds of genres. That's already happening.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that are just releasing VOD, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just VOD, but there's people who are releasing at the same time as well. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And that's kind of interesting to me, just because it's like, so
it's an
you don't care as long as they get it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an experimental market, and I think that's going to become more important once something or, you know, once the foreign market eventually ebbs, and it will, it can't keep going up like this forever.
Right.
I mean, we might still see more co-productions, but I think we're going to see less. Right now we have this cash cow, and I don't think that's going to last forever.
No, definitely not.
That doesn't even go into, like, international politics. Like, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future when it comes to, like, trade, tariffs, and war, and that kind of stuff. That could end up, you know, fucking things up, too. So all of this stuff is on a pretty shaky ground.
Interesting. Well, that's all I had. I didn't have anything too grandiose. I don't even really have much to say. It was just more kind of a what if, and...
Yeah.
I think you answered it quite well, but
mostly don't know what I'm talking about, but
yeah, I know,
but I'm just speculating like everyone is.
Yeah. You faked it good. I liked it.
Good. That's what well, let's go ahead and get into our reviews. Before we talk about Only Lovers Left Alive, which has been out for a few weeks, I'm going to talk about Neighbors. You didn't see that, did you?
No, I did not.
Okay. I didn't think so. And which I just saw yesterday. And Neighbors is the new Seth Rogen comedy, also co-starring Zac Efron. And it is directed by Nick Stoller, who most recently did the Muppets movie, but he's also, you know, in the Apatow world, and, like, did Get Him to the Greek and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And it stars Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, who plays his wife, and they're these kind of... early 30s, just had their first kid, trying to, like, get their shit together. You know, they're just passing from infantile pre-adulthood into we need to get our shit together, now we have jobs adulthood. And they're in, like, that crisis. Not a quarter-life crisis, but something a little after that. And what happens is basically next door, they're in a really nice kind of quiet neighborhood and they've just had this baby and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to, like, get out and, like, go and do things and still have dates and that kind of thing. But they're also trying to, like, be new parents. And Zac Efron moves in next door and turns the house into a frat house full of a bunch of dudes. One of them is played by Dave Franco. Christopher Mintz-Plasse is in there as well in his frat. They're kind of loud and obnoxious and adventurous, and Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen, they don't want to come off as lame, so they try and, like, go over there. They bring them weed and say, hey, we're all cool, you know, just keep it down and everything, and Efron and company say, yeah, sure, just give us a call if we're ever being too loud. And of course that doesn't work out, and eventually a war broods between the two. And it kind of becomes a little bit of sort of a bitter butter battle. this movie, I really want it to be funnier than it is. And I really want it to be funnier than it thinks it is. It's not a total wash. There's about six or so decent chuckles in the movie and a lot of nothing in between. It's, you know, the Apatow model, and which I shouldn't totally credit to him because he may have not even produced this one. But it has become sort of that brand with this group of let's get a bunch of actors together and we'll riff. We'll have a scene, we'll kind of know what we want in it, but we're basically just going to riff off of each other and basically just improv the whole thing, and then we'll whittle it down in the editing room. And that's fine if you have really talented people and if you have a fairly disciplined editor. And this movie is shorter than a lot of those movies. This movie is only about 97 minutes long, so I give it credit for that. It didn't go over 2 hours, which a lot of those movies tend to do. But it still feels very unstructured. And it still feels really undisciplined. And a lot of the jokes don't work. And a lot of the jokes are barely jokes.
Did your fan go on or something?
No, it's my neighbor guy. He likes to play with the garage door.
Oh.
Anyway...
You're gonna be neighbors now.
The two of them just get into this war and it keeps escalating, and of course that's what the joke is supposed to be. But I feel like, you know, even given this pretty simple premise, they still let scenes go on too long. They still milk jokes way longer than they've expired, and you know, no pun intended, there's a whole breast milk joke that runs throughout the whole movie. And a lot of it just doesn't really happen for me. I sat there going, why isn't this funny? It should be much funnier than it is. And, you know, I will say that I was kind of alone in this. A lot of people were howling in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wasn't feeling it, I have to say.
Well, my kind of experience, and I haven't seen the film, I'm just saying that, but my experience with kind of comedies in general, people go to them to laugh.
So they're looking to...
Well, yeah. They have the expectation, and they want to have a good time, and they want to feel good, basically. And so it's you know, I think it's very common. I think some movies aren't very funny or aren't very good, and people find them good or find them better than they are just because they want that experience from a comedy. Also, you know, the kind of experience you're talking about where they kind of ad-lib and stuff like that and that can improvise.
That can be funny, but...
But not lightning with all
the
writing,
not when the script stage is happening in the editing room.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes, but that's often, those kind of films are just a lightning in a bottle. It works then and there.
Yeah.
In like, I think of like the early Bill Murray stuff, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That crowd, Dan Aykroyd, all those movies were good, but some of them were only okay. And then some of them were great. And it was because whenever they got the right group, the right story, and just the right, like, synergy or whatever you want to call it, that's the time that those work. So,
and this movie has its moments. I mean, there's like one, I don't want to give it away, but there's one specific visual gag that really works. And it's one of the only jokes that I can feel like they actually tried to write it in. They didn't just, like, hope that the actors were going to bring it that day on set. And I think Zac Efron is actually really funny in this. He's probably the funniest thing in the movie. He really kind of plays that douchebag frat guy really well. And he still kind of brings sort of a little bit of sympathy to it. And it kind of a pathos that makes it sort of funny.
Yeah.
Sort of sending up his own image.
I let go of my, Zac Efron,
hate
when we watched, Harmony Korine's, Paperboy. And when he, peed on him.
Lee Daniels.
Lee Daniels. Yeah, I was wrong. That's right. It was Lee Daniels.
Yeah, and he's, and I think that he has something, and I think that he is a very charismatic person, and the camera really loves him, and I think that, I see a career in his future. I think that he can actually do it. And he's really funny in this, and the younger cast, actually, in general, tends to be funnier than the vetted comedians in the movie. it's still not that great. You still watch it and go, this is no Animal House.
Sure.
As much as it wants to be. But, yeah, I don't know. Some people like it more than I do, so what do I know?
Wow. Nice cap on that one, I suppose. A little negative, man. Are you okay? Do I need to call someone
I don't know. Specifically this kind of genre, I kind of feel like I have my opinions, but maybe I'm a little pickier on comedy than other people are. I don't know.
I mean, I agree with you, and I'm one of those people as well, but I just, you know, I still think that it's just as viable. I think people want to feel good about them, and I think that because they laughed and they felt good at that time, they attribute it to being better than it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen the movie. I'm not saying that about this film. I'm just saying in general about a lot of comedies.
Yeah, no, it's true. Well, let's go ahead and get into our main review for the week, and that is Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive, and I'll let you set that up.
It's about these two vampires, one played by Tilda Swinton, Eve, and the other one, Tom Hiddleston, playing Adam.
Uh-huh.
Basically, they're these kind of like old arty types, but they're also part of the vampire myth. And Tom Hiddleston, he lives in Detroit in this kind of deteriorating house and has Anton Yelchin like bringing him
provisions.
Mostly bringing him like presents, like guitars and stuff like that and stuff. He's really into music. That's his thing, and he's been behind the music scene since, you know, since the
like classical period.
Yeah, exactly. And then you've got Tilda Swinton, who's like the opposite. She's, you know, she's the book person, and she's always been into books, and she's also her kind of friend and / vampire, played by John Hurt, is Kit Marlowe.
Mm-hmm.
One of the Shakespeare peoples. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so...
And she's living in Tangier.
Yeah, and she's living in Tangier. Well, basically, he gets all depressed and mopey about the new generation, how everything's going wrong, and the film... I don't know if there's much of a plot. It's kind of almost like a character piece. Character piece. And it's more talking about stuff. And overall, I really like this film.
I did too.
I just really
It in a really funny way.
I do too. No, I think it's kind of really, really dry funny. But yeah. I think he's making fun of us. Like our generation. I really do.
Yeah.
But I think he's making fun of his generation too, but I'm not sure.
I think he's, I mean, the whole movie's full of social commentary.
But then I think it gets pretty like profound in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Towards the end. And so it's kind of like this, it kind of becomes like this, just kind of like the world is changing
mm-hmm.
and these kind of people just can't.
Yeah, they don't see their place in it anymore.
Yeah, and so... It's really, I don't know. It's really amusing, but sort of weird and sort of atmospheric. And it's just, it seems like it's just content. And I really don't have much to complain. I think it was a pretty interesting movie. It's very slow, but it's methodically slow.
Yeah. It's really laid back.
Well,
I would say I went and saw this with Brad and Amanda for the second time. I'd seen it once before, but they wanted to watch it, so I went with them. And we all kind of got out of the movie, and Brad sort of turned to us and said, "That movie is just fucking cool." And then this Alyssa, who's also on their podcast, turned to us and she's like, "Yeah, that's like the perfect way to describe this. It's just fucking cool."
No, it kind of is. No, but just a lot of the, like, there's this beautiful thing where they describe one of Einstein's theories to each other,
mm-hmm.
like, towards the end. And it's just this beautiful thing that kind of wraps it up. And it's funny, because some of the things they'll complain about, like, all these kids, like, poisoning their blood and all kinds of this stuff.
Yeah.
But then you get this really, like, heroin-esque, like...
vibe.
Like, when they take blood and stuff.
Yeah, there's this whole metaphor. It's pretty obvious that the vampire as this as the sort of the rock and roll junkie, you know, that we've sort of heroized and romanticized through the years. People like Lou Reed or people like Kurt Cobain.
Well, it was interesting, though, as well, that, I mean, so, yes, with Tom Hiddleston, but so you've got Tom Hiddleston, who is like this representation of music.
Yeah.
Tilda Swinton, who's like this representation of books.
Mm.
You've got this, you've got John Hurt, who's like this representation of plays.
Yeah.
And then you've got Mia Wasikowska, who does a part, who's kind of this representation of the film world. And like fame,
yeah, because she comes from L.A. Yeah. Mia Wasikowska, and it's and she brings a lot of fun energy. Like in the middle of this movie, which I said is very laid back. For some reason, they never actually explain it, but I sort of like that they don't explain it. Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton, Adam and Eve, live very far apart, but they're married, and you get the idea that maybe sometimes when you're married for eternity, you just need a couple hundred years apart sometimes.
Well, and then you might come like back
to each other.
Well, it also seems like it's not like
it's not
that
a
big
thing.
Deal. They love each other.
They love each other. And actually, the romance aspect of it, that's called Only Lovers Left Alive, is really nice. It's actually really well handled, and it's not treated like a joke. And you wouldn't think, you know, Tom Hiddleston's like 33, 34, and Tilda Swinton's like in her 50s, but they have really, really good romantic chemistry.
Agreed.
And just good screen chemistry in general.
And so, anyways, going back to something I was saying about all these people, like, being part of these things, it's almost a direct reference to the market of art itself.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost saying, like, these people, you know, because I got this really, like, while she's flipping through books and Tom Hiddleston is playing with, you know, he can't let go of some of these notions of music and what happened to it, and he's talking about all these old bands. There was a lot of commentary there about how all these markets, they don't know what to do in these new days.
Mm-hmm.
And so
sort of the commodification of art.
Yeah, the best thing that they can do is, like, you know, call the normal people zombies and stuff like that. But
yeah,
just in general, the atmosphere of the film, there's this one of this lovely scene that I liked was when they're in this old, there's also this other part where they're in this old theater.
And yeah,
they kind of almost give you a history lesson telling you that it's like one of the oldest theaters.
In Detroit,
but then they,
yeah.
Yeah. And then they pan out and it's a parking lot. And it's just sort of really, I don't know. It's just fucking cool, man.
Yeah. And at the end, there's this moment where Tom Hiddleston sees this, when they're in Tangier looking for blood and they're sort of starving. They're looking for a moment, he kind of looks into this performance of this woman. Then she does this whole song. There's a lot of musical numbers in here, which you would expect from a Jim Jarmusch movie. And he looks in and watches this performance, and him and Tilda Swinton have this conversation of, oh yeah, she's so good, she's destined to be famous. And he says, God, I hope not. Like, you know, like, that's the least of what she needs.
Right.
I think the movie actually has a lot to say subtly, but it's also a really effective comedy. We were laughing hysterically. Like, everyone else, I don't think they quite knew what to do with the movie, because it is so dry that if you're not on that wavelength, you just won't catch it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also really atmospheric. The way the movie opens, everything is kind of spinning like a record. Mm-hmm. And it keeps, you know, superimposing the vinyl record, and then you see their rooms as they're spinning, and it makes you sort of high. Like, you sort of, like, the movie, like, is sort of makes you stoned.
That's sort of an interesting. See, I just thought it was kind of
sort of a
to me, the slow methodical pace vibe. It does definitely has a psychedelic vibe, but specifically the speed of the film that I think is very integral to it. To me, you're kind of living at their pace.
Yeah,
and the only way they can. But, you know, you might be right about that high as well, just because of the blood thing we talked about earlier and being very reminiscent of taking heroin.
Yeah, and Jarmusch's band does the soundtrack for the whole movie, The Squirrels. And it's like this kind of, like, drony, sort of melancholy, gothy type stuff. And it is definitely plays into that atmosphere the whole time. And it's just, you know, this movie is sort of like the cinematic epitome of ennui. You know, everyone's just kind of lounging around, sunglasses hanging off their face. And they're too cool for everything.
Yeah.
And it's kind of great. I super love this movie.
Well, but yeah, and again, it was good. I agree. I think it's a wonderful film.
I don't know. I haven't, you know, the year is young, but this has so far been maybe one of my favorite, if not my favorite, last shots of a movie.
Oh, I think you're right. And the thing is watch, I don't know, just seeing this and Under the Skin so close together, they're just both so like, they're movies that just kind of, they haunt you, but like in a good way, like you just think about them and they're just kind of there with you.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of just like, I don't know, I'm feeling good about film right now.
There's a lot of interesting stuff that's not playing quite everywhere. But and I think, you know, especially the people who really got on board with Hiddleston because of Loki and want to see him do more, because we haven't seen him do a whole lot more, this is a really great, different kind of role for him.
Agreed.
And it shows more, you know, dimension of what we knew he could do. And, of course, Tilda Swinton's just amazing in everything.
Agreed.
Yeah. And this is, you know, she's practically was born to play this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, I did, too. And if you do have a chance, I would say go see it. I do know that there is a crowd that wouldn't be into this. And so if you're not into, like, art house kind of movies, if you're not smart,
like,
don't go see
you know, this, yeah, really. But I feel like this is the type of movie that, like, in 10 years, it's going to be like the cool, like the theater kids in high school who are kind of weirdos. They like get together and this is their favorite movie. Like, I feel like it's kind of one of those sort of movies. It's not so arty that it's like impenetrable. It's kind of like, it's for like the strange outsider type people.
It's definitely not impenetrable, but like I said, for me,
the pacing might throw off the general audience.
Yeah. That's a good, but it's integral to the film and the content is so there and so cool that I just, you know, I love that commentary about like old forms and like even the way the vampires look. Like this film in all designing aspects is pretty remarkable.
I would say. It's a pretty art directed movie. Well, let's go ahead and get into our last review of the week. And this was your homework to me. Off of Netflix Instant Streaming, Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson. And this is a story of a young woman who works in sort of a halfway house for troubled youths and teenagers. And she's trying to kind of get her own life together. She just found out she's pregnant. She's not sure if she's going to keep it or not. She's sort of secretly dating one of her coworkers. And doesn't know what to tell him, but she's trying to kind of manage her own life by managing the lives of these people who have it much worse than her at that moment. And we, you know, we get a kind of a good view of all of these different characters, all of these different kids that she's working with and all of their problems. And it's just sort of a character study about sort of this world of this, you know, pretty intimate group of people in this halfway house.
This film was, I think, really cool as well.
I thought it was really good.
This probably, honestly, if I would have saw this last year, I think it would have made my best 10 list.
Oh, wow, yeah. No, it was, I think it was really emotional.
It is, and I'm glad you said that, because I didn't know if I was having just an emotional day or if it really was the film, so I feel good. It's sort of strange because it gives you this unraveling effect. It doesn't show you straight up. It's like, and also all the situations feel real and relatable. And it's not like, it's not going for that, those warm and fuzzies, even though it gives you that in a lot of ways. But it also gives you some really hard things. What's kind of interesting is it is her, you know, so Brie Larson, who I've already discussed how, I'm I dig her.
You have a movie crush.
I have a movie crush on her.
Yeah.
And I think she's great in this. I think that I don't think there's really... I think she's very believable, and I think she's very... She sells some really dark, heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But what I think her character goes through in this film is I really think that she's getting her therapy through working with these kids. You know?
Yeah.
She's saving herself in a lot of ways, or trying to save herself.
Yeah.
And I think that's fairly obvious, but what the film does, I think this film also sets mood really well, but in a different way. It kind of does it. It kind of gives you almost a documentary feel at times.
Especially how it deals with these teens is like, you get to know a little bit about this character, and there's, you know, I kind of have a good scene with that one. And then you move on to the next room and they have their own kind of scene. And it does have that kind of sort of documentary vibe in that sense.
Yeah. But I just think there's different scenes, and it just depends. Like, she kind of takes these like moody bike rides at times, and it's, I thought it was a really good film. I wouldn't say it's chocked full of content necessarily, but it definitely does give you this very intimate, very,
it's just a big heaping pile of the human condition.
That's a great way to say it. Yes.
And it is kind of raw. And yeah. It is, it feels very real. And, you know,
that's what I'm talking about, is the cinematography was kind of raw. Like they kind of did the shaky cam thing, not in an annoying way though, or like just.
And not all the time.
Yeah. And the shots were just maybe just a little off kilter at times and stuff like that. And so.
You really felt in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
I delivered meds. It was the last job I had before I started grad school. And I had to deliver to places like this. There's a few in Pocatello, Idaho.
I knew a girl that worked at one.
Yeah. And I would always, you know, peek my head in, you know, and have to knock on the door. I have their meds for them, and they would, you know, their caretaker or whatever would have to sign for it. And I would always peek in, and all these like 13, 14, 15 year olds playing like video games and stuff. And I was like, there's a story in here. Like, this should be a movie. Like, you know, I literally actually thought that before. It's like this, you know, I mean, that was like Party for Five or whatever in the 90s. But I was like, this is a really like interesting setting. And then this movie is exactly that. And it's exactly what I would have wanted that to be. It is kind of dour, I would say. It's kind of depressing. It's not a happy film. It's pretty heavy most of the time.
Definitely is heavy.
And it's not a movie you're going to want to watch to put you in a good mood, but it's, the performances are so good, and it's, everyone's, you know, playing it so, you know, for real. And I feel like, you know, even in Hollywood, in these types of movies, even in indie films, a lot of times there's this Hollywood elite thing, and it shouldn't bug me, but it kind of does when you go to their, like, you know, from the workplace environment into their homes, and they have like these mansions essentially that they live in, and they don't treat it like that's a weird thing. This is a movie about real people in America who have real jobs in America and live on real incomes.
Yeah.
And that was just nice to see, like actual middle America, like, represented.
And it didn't feel stilted. Like,
yeah.
Cause sometimes a film like this can, like, but I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you completely. I think that there are some very depressing stuff in here.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely shows you a dose of reality for certain, people within our, within this country. But I would say it wraps it up pretty. I liked the ending and how everything came full circle, and it kind of.
Yeah, it's not nihilistic.
No.
It's just really heavy.
To me, it is, but it was. I think it had a very happy ending and a positive message. And to me, this is what in those dreaded films that you hate, the fuzzy wuzzy films.
Mm-hmm.
This is what most of those should be.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you have all the ingredients here to make a really on-the-nose, sentimental movie. But this movie totally avoids that. And that alone is kind of a tight wire act.
Well, I'm trying to think of that word you use, the saccharine.
Yes.
It's not saccharine. This is completely...
And the teenagers act like real teenagers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, especially, you know, troubled teenagers.
Well, this is kind of, I would say, you know, thinking about it just right now, this is kind of like in almost a, like a, I mean, it's definitely not in this period, but it's kind of the, like, Italian realism.
Kind of. I would say it has that sort of atmosphere for sure. So. And I kind of adored this movie. I thought it was great. And, you know, good for Brie Larson. Again, like we were talking about with Hiddleston, it's nice to see her have a good, hefty role to really sink her teeth into.
Yeah, and I really do think she was fantastic in this. This isn't just my crush talking either. I think that she delivers. I mean, the film is about her, and so, anyway.
All right. Well, what do we have next week? We're having a guest on the podcast. I don't know if I should announce it.
Next week, we should be having Kyle from KaijuCast.
Yes. And we'll be talking about Godzilla.
Yeah, he assigned us the film...
Godzilla versus Mothra?
Yes. That's what it is. In Netflix, it's Godzilla versus Mothra, but I guess the original title is Godzilla versus the Thing.
So we'll be having an all Godzilla cast next week with the new American remake, as well as this Godzilla versus Mothra.
Exactly, and he will be our resident expert. So this it should be pretty exciting. So. I definitely recommend everybody listen to the next episode.
Yeah.
All of our episodes, a-holes.
Yeah, why aren't you? except for that guy in Canada. And if anybody wants to submit questions, kaiju-related questions, to Kyle, he is our resident kaiju expert, and we're not joking around with this. Like, he knows his shit. You can do that with our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com, as well as any other comments on anything we talked about today. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there. You can see the news items when we post them, and you can also see when we're posting episodes or if there's going to be any delays or anything weird. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and Pocket Casts and... Listen to us on your favorite mobile device. When you're at Stitcher and iTunes, please leave us a review and a star rating. You can read my writings over at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, where I review movies for the Idaho State Journal every week. You can see some of the content I provided for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can see Richard's new blog over at rdwally.weebly.com. And be sure to check out Brad and Amanda and Alyssa's podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com. And be sure to listen to next week, because we're going to be getting deep into Godzilla.
That's what she said.
All right. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Bye.